Most people believe that child protection services are there to save children from harm. But what if the system doesn't just fail? It chooses to look away. Gabriel Fernandez was just 8 years old when he died, and his injuries were so severe that seasoned ER doctors broke down in tears. He had a fractured skull, broken ribs, BB pellets embedded in his lungs and groin, burns, missing teeth, and fresh wounds layered over scars. But here's what will haunt you. Social workers had visited his home. Teachers had filed reports. The sheriff's department had been warned again and again. And still, Gabriel was returned each time to the very people who tortured him. This isn't just the story of a little boy's murder. It's a story about how cruelty hid in plain sight, and how a bureaucratic system full of educated adults left him to die. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The Warnings. No one heard. The bruises started almost immediately after Gabriel Fernandez moved into the apartment on 2100 East Avenue Q in Palmdale, California. He was just 7 years old when his mother, Pearl Cynthia Fernandez, regained custody of him after years of barely being involved in his life. Until then, Gabriel had lived happily with his great uncle and his partner, both of whom had nurtured him with the gentleness and structure any child deserves. But Pearl, who had abandoned him as an infant at the hospital, suddenly wanted him back, and the courts let her take him. Why? That question would echo like a ghost through Los Angeles County for years after Gabriel's death. Pearl's record was clear. She had a documented history of drug use, mental illness, and prior allegations of abuse. Her boyfriend, Isauro Aguirre, was a security guard with no formal education, past the ninth grade, described by co-workers as polite, even quiet. No one knew he would turn into a sadist once behind closed doors. But the first signs didn't come from the hospital. They came from the classroom. His face was bruised again, said Jennifer Garcia, Gabriel's first grade teacher, during court testimony. He said his mom hit him with a belt buckle. She reported it. Again. And again. Each time she filled out the proper forms. Each time she made follow-up calls. Once Gabriel brought in a homemade Valentine's Day card he'd written for his mother, decorated with hearts and careful cursive writing, and proudly told his teacher that he loved her. Hours later, he returned to class with bruises around his eyes. Jennifer wasn't alone. The school's administrators knew something was wrong. Multiple reports had been filed with the Los Angeles County Department of Children and Family Services, DCFS. In fact, between October 2012 and May 2013, the span of just 8 months, DCFS was contacted over 5 times about Gabriel's welfare, and it wasn't just bruises. Gabriel had told teachers he was being shot with BB guns, that he slept locked in a cabinet, that he wasn't allowed to eat. His hair had been shaved. He smelled like urine. But it's what the adults didn't do that makes this story unforgettable. Social workers visited the house, yes, but their reports minimized Gabriel's injuries. They described him as quiet and well-mannered. When he refused to speak about the abuse during one visit, it was chalked up to shyness. No deeper investigation was made. Despite multiple red flags, the agency closed the case, and the abuse continued. Inside the Palmdale apartment, Gabriel was subjected to psychological and physical torture that defies comprehension. According to later court records, Aguirre and Fernandez believed Gabriel was gay, and that alone was enough to provoke monstrous cruelty. They beat him with a bat. They burned him with cigarettes. They forced him to eat cat feces, spoiled food, and his own vomit. They taped his mouth shut and locked him in a cabinet for hours, even days, often naked and gagged. The cabinet. It was small, dark, lined with feces. The family kept air fresheners near it, not to mask the smell of garbage, but to cover up the odor of a slowly dying child. Aguirre, in particular, seemed to relish the control. Testimony would later reveal that he laughed as he beat Gabriel, that he taunted him as he cried, that he told the boy he was worthless, that he called him a faggot. Still, the system didn't act. A sheriff's deputy responded to one of the teacher's reports in March 2013, 2 months before Gabriel's death. but claimed there was no visible sign of abuse. No medical evaluation was conducted. The deputy didn't even interview Gabriel privately. It was later revealed that neither DCFS nor law enforcement ever cross-referenced their visits or concerns. There was no unified file, no chain of urgency, no call to act before it was too late. Meanwhile, Gabriel was slowly dying. On May 22, 2013, Gabriel's body gave out. That evening, Aguirre allegedly lost control when Gabriel asked if he could play with his siblings. For that simple question, Aguirre punched him repeatedly in the face, knocked him unconscious, and kicked him so hard in the stomach that Gabriel's small ribs broke and punctured his lungs. Pearl did nothing. When Gabriel stopped breathing, they tried to wipe the blood off him and hide the damage. Only when he failed to wake did they finally call 911. Paramedics arrived to find a boy, who had been dead for hours, in all but name. His skin was cold, his body covered in open wounds, bruises, cigarette burns, and bite marks. He wasn't breathing. He had no pulse. They rushed him to Children's Hospital Los Angeles, where doctors were horrified at what they saw. Gabriel's injuries were consistent with prolonged torture, not just a single beating. He was placed on life support, but it was already too late. His brain had swollen. His heart had failed. 2 days later, on May 24, 2013, Gabriel Fernandez died. The media exploded. The details of Gabriel's death and the stomach-churning reality that his death had been preventable sparked nationwide outrage. But what made it worse was what followed, the reaction of the very agencies that had failed him. DCFS claimed they had followed protocol. The sheriff's department denied responsibility, and the public was left screaming into a void. But a few brave voices refused to let the case be buried. Prosecutors pursued first-degree murder charges against both Pearl Fernandez and Isauro Aguirre. The case became one of the most highly publicized child abuse trials in California's history. During the trial, jurors broke down. Courtroom staff cried. Some members of the media had to step out to collect themselves. The prosecution laid out every injury, every warning sign, and every institutional failure. The aim was not just justice, but truth. And that truth was damning. Gabriel had wanted to be a police officer. He had drawn pictures of guns and badges and police cars. He once asked a classmate if the police could protect him from his mom. He had written a note on construction paper that read, "I love you. Mom and Gabriel is a good boy." It was found folded under his bed. He still believed love could save him. In 2017, Isauro Aguirre was convicted of first-degree murder with special circumstances of torture. He was sentenced to death. Pearl Fernandez took a plea deal to avoid trial and received life in prison without parole. But the most shocking twist wasn't their sentences. It was the system that stood behind them. Four social workers were charged with child abuse and falsifying records. It was the first time in California history that child protection employees were criminally charged in connection with the death of a child on their watch. But in 2020, those charges were thrown out by an appeals court. No social worker was ever held accountable. As of today, DCFS continues to operate in Los Angeles County. The department has made internal reforms, implemented new tracking protocols, and expanded training. But critics argue the changes are superficial. Thousands of children still fall through the cracks. Gabriel Fernandez is no longer just a name. He is a symbol of what happens when adults turn away, when protocols replace instinct, and when systems fail to do the one thing they were created to do: protect the innocent. Chapter 2. The trials, the documents, the denials. The courtroom was so quiet, that day you could hear the click of every camera shutter. Rows of spectators, many wearing buttons bearing Gabriel Fernandez's name, filled the pews. Some were teachers, others were parents. A few were complete strangers who had seen Gabriel's story online and couldn't turn away. The trial of Isauro Aguirre, charged with capital murder, was underway. But this wasn't just a legal proceeding. It was a national reckoning. As the prosecutor, Deputy District Attorney Jonathan Hatami, approached the jury box, he didn't open with legalese. He opened with something far more damning. "This case is about pure evil." Hatami was a former child abuse survivor himself. And as he laid out the charges, murder with special circumstances of torture. His voice didn't waver. For nearly 2 hours, he described every wound, every scar, every missed opportunity that led to Gabriel's death. He described the BB pellets embedded in Gabriel's lung and groin. He showed photographs of the burned scalp. He pointed to the x-rays of fractured ribs, broken teeth, and a cracked skull. Several jurors cried. A few had to step out, but Hatami didn't hold back. This wasn't discipline. This was torture. Systematic, deliberate, and fueled by hate. The defense had little to offer. They didn't deny the abuse. They didn't argue that Aguirre was innocent. Instead, they tried to humanize him. Aguirre, they said, was slow, easily manipulated by Pearl Fernandez. His lawyers described him as remorseful, confused, even stunned by his own behavior. But the jury didn't buy it, neither did the judge. The facts spoke louder. Gabriel's injuries weren't just from one night. They had accumulated over 8 brutal months. And during those months, Aguirre never once sought help, never told a friend, never tried to stop. In fact, the most damning evidence came from Aguirre's own co-workers. Patricia Clement, a fellow security guard at the Vallarta supermarket where Aguirre worked, testified that he once bragged about making Gabriel clean his own blood off the walls. Another witness said Aguirre laughed when recounting how Gabriel screamed. Yet another revealed that Aguirre once said, "That kid is a pain. He's gay. I'm going to make him hate himself." These were not the words of a man too slow to understand. They were the words of a predator. In November 2017, Isauro Aguirre was found guilty. The jury took less than a day to deliberate. During sentencing, the prosecution pushed for death. The defense pleaded for mercy. The judge, however, didn't waver. Aguirre was sentenced to death by lethal injection, though due to California's capital punishment policies, he remains on death row. But Gabriel's mother, Pearl Fernandez, would never face a jury. She accepted a plea deal in 2018, guilty to first-degree murder, with special circumstances. In exchange, she avoided the death penalty. The courtroom was again packed, as she was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. Before sentencing, she made a brief statement. "I want to say I'm sorry to my family for what I did. I wish Gabriel was still alive." Her face remained expressionless. There were no tears. Judge George G. Lomelli looked directly at her and said, "You want to say you're sorry? Sorry to your family? What about sorry to Gabriel?" Still, the public outrage wasn't just directed at the killers. It turned squarely toward DCFS. For the first time in California history, 4 social workers were criminally charged in connection to a child's death. Patricia Clement, not to be confused with Aguirre's co-worker, Gregory Merritt, Stephanie Rodriguez, and Kevin Baum were each charged with felony child abuse and falsifying public records. The charges were historic, but also highly controversial. The prosecution's argument was simple. The social workers had documentation. They had seen reports, spoken to teachers, visited the home, and witnessed Gabriel's bruises. Yet time and again, they chose not to act. Even worse, they allegedly altered their reports to make conditions sound safer than they were. "They didn't just fail Gabriel," Hatami said. "They helped send him back into that house." Defense attorneys fired back, warning that criminalizing caseworkers would create a chilling effect, discouraging people from working in child welfare. They insisted that DCFS was overburdened, underfunded, and drowning in thousands of cases. Mistakes were made, they said, but criminal intent wasn't one of them. The courtroom watched as the legal tide shifted. The charges were dismissed in 2020 by the California 2nd District Court of Appeal. The panel ruled that the social workers could not be held criminally liable under the current interpretation of state law. Their rationale? The workers did not have care and custody of Gabriel in the way that criminal law defines it. All 4 walked free. But Gabriel's story wasn't over. It was just entering its second life in the public sphere. In 2020, Netflix released The Trials of Gabriel Fernandez, a 6-part documentary that pulled no punches. The series, created by documentarian Brian Knappenberger, featured interviews with Hatami, teachers, family members, and child welfare advocates. The series didn't just aim to tell Gabriel's story. It aimed to dissect it. Episode by episode, the audience saw how each failure built upon the last, how warnings were minimized, how bureaucratic language replaced human urgency. It ended with a harrowing conclusion. The system didn't just fail Gabriel. The system enabled his death. But here's what most people didn't see. During the investigation, a series of handwritten letters and internal DCFS memos surfaced, documents that would later be examined in public hearings and policy reviews. One was from Jennifer Garcia, Gabriel's teacher. Dated 6 weeks before his death, it was addressed to a social worker, pleading for intervention. She detailed Gabriel's bruises, his statements, and the visible emotional distress he displayed. There was no response. Another internal DCFS memo outlined a plan to close Gabriel's case file, stating, "No further investigation needed at this time." The memo cited a lack of cooperation from the family and no observable immediate risk. That same week, Gabriel was locked in a cabinet and beaten for asking to play. Most devastating of all were Gabriel's own words, scribbled in pencil on the back of a worksheet. It was discovered in his desk drawer after his death. It read, "Why do people hate me?" Next to it was a stick figure drawing of a boy in a cage with tears falling from his eyes. Gabriel was never invisible. He was seen. He was heard. And still, he died. In response, lawmakers launched multiple investigations into DCFS and child protective practices in California. A Blue Ribbon Commission was formed. Reforms were promised. Some policies changed, training improved, hotline protocols were strengthened, inter-agency communication was revamped. But child advocates warned, policy does not equal protection. Today, Gabriel's name remains etched into the public consciousness. His face, once hidden behind black eyes and bruises, has become a symbol of resistance for teachers, social workers, and child advocates who refuse to let another child slip through the cracks. Some schools now use his case in training seminars. Advocacy groups have created entire campaigns, Be the One Who Speaks, using Gabriel's story to empower students and educators to report abuse. His siblings, though removed from Pearl's custody, have never publicly spoken about their time in that apartment. Their lives are now protected by sealed court records and child privacy laws. But in interviews, extended family members have hinted at the long shadow Gabriel's death cast over them. The guilt, the what-ifs, the quiet questions asked in therapy rooms and living rooms behind closed doors. The apartment in Palmdale remains. 2100 East Avenue Q. Neighbors say it's still occupied, but no one talks about the past. Some claim the screams still echo. Others say the place feels colder, darker. Whether haunted or not, the building remains a grave marker. Victim's voice, letters and interviews that expose systemic failure. Gabriel's legacy lives on in the rawest way, through the people who couldn't save him but refused to stay silent. Jennifer Garcia now travels across the country, speaking to educators about the legal and moral responsibility to report abuse. In one interview, she said, "I still see his face. Every time I walk into my classroom, I think, would Gabriel have made it to second grade?" Jonathan Hatami has become an outspoken critic of child welfare failings. In speeches, he's blasted DCFS, calling for criminal accountability and deeper reforms. "I don't want to prosecute another case like Gabriel's, ever again." The Los Angeles Times obtained redacted emails from DCFS in a FOIA request, revealing a deeply fractured culture within the department. Some workers expressed remorse. Others blamed supervisors. One email simply read, "We were too late, again. But the final word might belong to Gabriel's great uncle, who raised him until Pearl took custody. At a memorial, he said, 'Gabriel used to ask me if people went to heaven when they were good. I told him yes, and now I hope he knows that we saw him, that we remember, that we will never forget.'" No reform, no verdict, no documentary will ever undo what happened in that small Palmdale apartment. But the question still lingers, like a wound that won't close. How many other Gabriels are still out there? Waiting, warning, surviving, while the system stays blind?